Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Another week is in the history books. Here it is, the 28th day of September, 2012, and when we meet again, when next we meet again, it will be October. I want to start the program out by thanking you all for helping us meet our fundraising goals for the month of September. That's huge in order for us to have an October. And thus, we will begin October's fundraising soon. Well, we've already begun it because you decided to begin it. We are still $20 away from meeting Texas Betsy's new job challenge. So if anybody wants to kick that in this evening, that would be wonderful. And probably, there's been, by the way, some issues. I had a note from Ben Birch over at White Rose Society. He's had some software issues that have messed up his recordings of the program, and that's why the podcasts have been a little bit squirrely, but he says that will be getting sorted out post-haste. Your patience is appreciated. It's Friday on the front porch here at the Horn. It's been raining all day long here in the hills and hollers of almost level West Bicod, Virginia. Of course, that's to be expected from time to time because this is a temperate rainforest. Or it was before the coal companies began blasting away 500 or so mountains with plans to blast more. Yeah. And of course, that involves the deforestation of the this huge temperate rainforest. But it is. It's been rainy and kind of gray all day long. But that's all right. There are lots of places in this country that would love to have that rain. You know? It is Friday on the front porch. That means we will engage in a little, I don't know, maybe a little more lighthearted, a little bit more easygoing conversation. Or not. Things can change. I mean, for instance, I got this email from Dr. John earlier asking, haven't these folks ever heard of the Mama Rule? You know what the Mama Rule is. It's a rule that says you don't say nothing about Mama. It is held to be sacrosanct, especially in the South. Dr. John also noting with regard to this story, man, the biracial thing just eats them alive, don't it? And it does. It does. The story in particular is of the latest sleazing of President Barack Obama. And the rule, the Mama Rule, apparently does not apply to this president. Amanda Marcotte, writing at Slate, in a story headlined, "Conservatives stoop to slut-shaming Obama's dead mother." Well, first, right. what was it, 2009, when the Republican Party's candidate for president, when his church dead baptized the poor woman who had just suffered through a terrible, trying bout of cancer. She wasn't long in the dirt before the Mormons dead baptized her. Amanda Marcotte writing, frustrated Obama obsessives, unable to believe that the rest of the country doesn't share their paranoid suspicion that the president has dark secrets lurking under his amiable exterior, have finally stooped to slurring his mother through the time-honored method of calling her a slut. And the story is about a new, Amanda Marcotte refers to as a new round of rumor mongering about Obama's origins, in which it is now claimed that Barack Obama's father was not Barack Obama's father because Barack Obama's mother was sleeping all over the place. It refers to a BS documentary called Dreams from My Real Father. See, isn't that clever, the play on the word, the title of the Obama book? Yeah, that documentary is being mailed around to voters in so-called swing states. Amanda Marcotte says, Dreams from My Real Father peddles a conspiracy theory so convoluted that more traditional birthers must be envious of its creativity. The director, Joel Gilbert, argues that Obama's real father is Frank Marshall Davis, a labor activist and poet, and that Davis took bondage photos of Obama's mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, that he then sold to nudie magazines. Naturally, these questionable photos are prominently displayed in the documentary, and a short clip from the movie with the photos is available for embedding on every 2-bit birther blog on the Internet. Gilbert claims to have mailed out 1 million copies to voters in Ohio, and in this post-Citizens United era, it's quite possible he does have anonymous donors who made that kind of mail push possible. The other player in this sleazy act is of no surprise to you or me, Dinesh D'Souza. He accuses Stanley Ann Dunham of neglecting her son so she could sleep around Indonesia, painting her as a sexual predator and pretending to be amazed that she supposedly got it on so often despite being a heavy woman.
Huh? What, Edith?
You would hope that the American people who receive such a thing would actually hold that family values candidate, Bishop Willard Romney, to account for it. That they would recognize the violation of the mama rule. Don't talk about mama. But I don't know about this country anymore. I don't know. Because the biracial thing, as Dr. John notes, really does drive these white conservative antediluvian goobers around the bend. Reminds me of that video that was produced for Bill Maher's program where the journalist went to Mississippi and found, of course, someone went, I don't like him because he's a half-breed. Oh, yuck. Just yuck. Dr. John says he's calling it Empty Glass Friday. Well, that's what happens after you come up on the front porch and you pour a little jigger or so out of that crockery jug with the corn cob stopper. Or maybe you just have a glass of lemonade or sweet iced tea.
This is it's unconscionable. These right-wingers who claim to be imbued with such finely developed morals because they're in the church every time they unlock the doors. Never mind the question of why the church needs to keep the doors locked. We'll go past that. Jim asking the question, remember McCain's black love child? Yeah, they sleazed him with, the Bush people sleazed John McCain with that in South Carolina. Never mind that the child had been adopted. Never mind that it was a manifest good. The robocalls went all over that state during in 2000. Did you know that John McCain has a Negro daughter? We got race mixing in among the candidates. At least George Bush's daughters, even though they might have been conceived in a test tube, at least they were conceived white. I remember that, Jim. Thanks for the reminder. What else is there out there today? There's some stuff that I've been wanting to make sure that we got to because it is a representation of American reality that gets mighty short shrift. An interesting development in Phoenix, Arizona, of late. The mayor of Phoenix, Greg Stanton, accepted a challenge to live on a food stamp budget for a week as his observation of Hunger Awareness Month. He kept a diary on the challenge. It allotted him roughly $29 a week. That's the same amount that 1.1 million people in Arizona get from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. Every week, $29. Don't spend it all in one place, and eat hearty, me mateys. On day four, Greg Stanton's diary entry read like this. Okay, ran out the door today with no time to scramble eggs or even make a sandwich. So I'm surviving on an apple and handful of peanuts and the coffee I took to the office until dinner. I'm tired, and it's hard to focus. I can't go buy a sandwich because that would be cheating. Even the dollar menu at Taco Bell is cheating. You can't use SNAP benefits at any restaurants, fast food or otherwise. I'm facing a long, hungry day and even longer night getting dinner on the table, which requires making everything from scratch on this budget. It's only for a week, so I've got a decent attitude. If I were doing this with no end in sight, I probably wouldn't be so pleasant. And there are questions inside this story. One, Republican or Democrat, I don't know, but I respect Mayor Stanton for at least giving it a try. There's nothing like a walk in someone else's shoes to give you an appreciation for how tired feet can get at the end of a day. $29 a week for food? That's barbaric. It is just slightly less barbaric than not doing it at all.
But the fiscal family values Republicans
in the House are offended by it. This is one of those situations that they describe by saying,
we have created a culture of government dependency in this country, and people have lost their liberty.
Well, how free are you if you're starving? Of course, these ignorant trolls also don't understand that the origins of the food supplement program were not altruistically aimed toward feeding poor people, but were instead aimed at creating a welfare program for farmers to buy excess produce, which the government then had to unload somewhere, and well, you might as well let the poor people eat it. Such were the origins of that magnificent cheese. And darn good peanut butter. Of flour and rice and beans. But then the capitalists realized that they were missing out on some of the fun, so the food stamp program was created, in which people could actually go to retailers and buy what they wanted, at, of course, inflated retail prices. But that was no good, because sometimes the poor people were given cash back in change, and you know what they do with that cash? Why, they just go out there and they buy themselves some alcohol or some beer or liquor or maybe some Thunderbolt Lightning wine. And you can't have poor people doing that. They're not responsible enough to get liquored up like us well-heeled people do. Probably ain't even ashamed to go in the liquor store like a deacon is. $29 a week. I go to the grocery store periodically. $29 doesn't buy much. If you live on staple bread, eggs, beans, rice, it still doesn't go very far. Coffee is very expensive. We talked a little bit about coffee last night in our conversation with Preston. But that's the reality of hunger. Our idea of alleviating hunger is to provide people $29 a week on which to eat. Why isn't it 50? Why not at least $10 a day? 70. The answer to that is fairly simple. Because in this country, we have good, upstanding, God-fearing Republicans who, one supposes, think that hunger is somehow beneficial to the soul. Well, maybe they'll spend a little more time praying instead of eating. Live on hay day by day. There'll be pie in the sky when you die. That's that $29 a day. That's children, elderly, working people, the working poor. Dr. John noted, Mayor Stanton lost 4 pounds that week. A nice one-week fitness regimen, Dr. John observes. Of course, how long can you lose 4 pounds a week and, well, you know, survive? I thought I said he was the mayor of Phoenix. Maybe I did say Tucson. He's a Democrat. Wikipedia notes he is a former Phoenix City Council member who represented areas of North Phoenix. He defeated Republican political consultant lobbyist Wes Gullett after a contentious campaign that resulted in large election turnout. Gullett. Goddess of irony working out there again. Ron and Raleigh noting, I thought that diary entry might say something like, damn, I'm hungry. It probably would have, but it was being created for purposes of publication, so maybe not. Right, Jim, don't forget the good stuff, MD 2020. Wild Irish Rose? Yeah. But an associated story that was sent to me by my buddy from Twitter, the Angry Indian, with whom I did an interview about the AIC Act. This story, of course, comes out of Georgistan. It's the story of a woman using her food stamps credit card thing. I am not surprised that this story happens in Georgia. Why? Because I have from time to time heard for years that vulgar filthmonger Neil Bortz railing against people being fed on the government dole. It is the story of Cindy Nerger from Warner Robins, Georgia. Cindy Nerger is 28 years old. She has the SNAP card, the food stamp card, because of what has happened in her family. She became eligible for Medicare and Social Security supplemental security income because in 2008, when she was 24, she experienced kidney failure. She cannot hold down a job because she has daily 12-hour dialysis cycles. Her husband is a carpenter, running a business, doing the best he can, but when there's no work, there's no work. And this has been a hell of a time to be an independent contractor carpenter. Cindy Nerger says, if he doesn't get a call for a job, we don't have any extra money for the month. This is the kind of person who is aided in eating food and remaining alive by that president whom the Republicans have referred to as the food stamp president, who is creating a culture of dependency. Because Republicans begrudge someone like Cindy Nerger the pissant, pitiful amount of food assistance that she receives. What happened to Cindy Nerger? She said when she would go to the grocery store, she said, I felt shy when I used them, and my husband does too. I'd tried to hide the card. And this story is dated the 25th of September, and it refers to something that happened last week. She went to Kroger's. Checked out her items, and the cashier told her she owed $10, and Cindy Nerger said that's not possible because she knew that all the items in her cart were covered by the SNAP card. You know, you can't, it seems crazy to me, but I guess lines have to be drawn somewhere. At least that's what Bibi Netanyahu says. And one of the lines in this country is that food stamp benefits cannot be used to purchase something like, say, aluminum foil, or toilet paper, or scouring powder, or clothing detergent. It's about food, damn it! And apparently cannot be used to purchase hot food that you could eat immediately. You have to purchase, for instance, if you went to the deli section there in that Kroger, you could get slices of cheese and slices of ham or roast beef or turkey, but you could not get a hot ham and cheese sandwich that had been prepared there. But food stamp shoppers learn to be smart shoppers. They learn pretty quick what is and isn't covered, and because they don't have a lot of cash in pocket to begin with, They make sure that they get stuff that the food stamp card will cover. So at the Kroger last week, when Cindy Nerger was told you owe $10, she said, that's not possible. This is all covered. Eventually, a manager was called over. And finally, after she remonstrated with him, he said, oh, just give it to her. At which point Cindy Nerger said, see, I told you it was covered by food stamps. And the manager looked at her and said, well, excuse me for working for a living and not relying on food stamps. This was all going down as people were waiting, and the line was growing longer in the checkout at the Kroger's behind her. She said, I turned around and saw everyone beyond me, and I just burst into tears. Kroger made amends by offering her a $15 gift card. She said, no thanks. Kroger also told the TV station WMAZ that the manager had been transferred to another store. Well, great! That's wonderful! Hey, that's some good corporate responsiveness, Kroger. Now he can go somewhere else and humiliate another person trying to cling to life. That jerk needed to be fired, plain and simple. Ron and Raleigh answering my question about why can't it be 50 bucks a week or 70. Well, Bob, if it was 50 bucks a week, the safety net would become a food-filled hammock. P.S., can we get Governor Chris Krispy Kreme to try that food stamp? No, it's none of our business. He'd just tell us off and explain to us that we didn't understand the stress he had to deal with, and it's a hard job, don't you know? Right, Marty. This is just the sort of person Pastor John Hagee must be thinking of when he shouts, starve! If you won't get off your blessed assurance, then starve! America is the most charitable nation on earth. And then this is the disturbing part. By way of rounding out the story and wrapping it up, Ms. Nerger said she's sure there are some people out there on food stamps who are just lazy. I've never met one. I've met a lot of poor folks struggling to hang on and struggling to survive, and they work like the dickens surviving in this brutal place. Ms. Nerger went on to say, I've seen some comments from people talking about how they hate standing in line with somebody who's got food stamps because they've got two carts full of food. Did you not realize maybe this person isn't able to get to the grocery store but once a month? Ms. Nerger says she doesn't have cable and she hasn't been following politics or the presidential election. She doesn't like either candidate, either President Obama or Bishop Willard Romney. And then this, in case you were feeling terribly solicitous toward Cindy Nerger, and I feel sympathy for her for what she was put through in that grocery store. This is the closing quote. They're all going to kill us. Most of the people that we have to choose from, Obama with his spending and his health care reform, and then Mitt Romney, he just wants to let poor people die, so either way we're doomed, so I don't see any point in voting. Sister, there's a difference. It's really all you can say, isn't it? There is a difference. One side despises food stamps. The other side tries to protect them. One side is filled with people who think that not starving is a sign of divine favor, while the other side is comprised largely of people who understand that sometimes people fall on hard times. Ms. Nerger did not choose to get kidney failure. But still, she thinks that she doesn't like either one of them. And I'm just saying, I don't think she's a Jill Stein voter either. No. No. Jim noting how magnanimous of Kroger, the $15 gift card. He says, I have seen this scene personally. It is so degrading. Well, excuse me for working and not relying on food stamps. Reckon he'll ever say something like that again? One would hope not. So there's that, you know, just catching up. And a host of other stories as well. The story, for instance, and hard to stomach it is, of the little old lady who got blown away by police. Search warrant recovers bullet fragment in Alta Vista fatal shooting. Alta Vista being in Virginia. The Old Dominion. It was last Wednesday, not this past, but the Wednesday week. When an officer responded to a 911 call the 911 call came from Delma Towler, or perhaps Toller. Somebody called 911 from her residence but hung up before speaking with dispatchers. Two officers went to the home, as the news story puts it, where identical statuettes of the Sacred Heart of Jesus flanked the steps up to the front door. Officers made repeated attempts to determine if anybody was inside. A gunshot was heard within the house, at which point Delma Toller left her house from the back door with a pistol in her hand. She was going toward her sister's house, two houses down. The police saw her. They hollered for her to put down her weapon. She didn't. She raised it.
and one of the two police officers blew her away. Shot her dead. The officers and police department involved are awaiting the outcome of an investigation by the Virginia State Police. She was a couple of feet from her sister's house when police shot her. She lived alone, and she was afraid of break-ins. I've known a lot of elderly folk who feared such things. We've got a lady here in town who apparently can't see real well and can't see the keypad very well, and calls here 10 or 12 times a day, thinking she is calling her daughter. Agnes takes the calls. The lady tells her how sad she is, how afraid she is. One day she called saying, "Help me, please help me." And it turned out that she had turned her lunch, her hamburger, over in the floor where the dog had eaten it. And she called saying, "Help me, someone, please help me." That's who I thought of when I saw the story of Velma Toler. Police helped her all right. Helped her right off to those pearly gates, where she need have no fear, no more, no how. Never. It's a tough time to be old or infirm or differently abled in this country. A double amputee down in Houston at a group home got kind of cranky with an officer of the law. Had one arm, one leg, sitting in a wheelchair. This is an Associated Press story with some bad journalism in it. Work with me here. Police spokeswoman Jody Silva said the man cornered the officer in his wheelchair and was making threats while trying to stab the officer with a pen. Doesn't that sound like the officer was in his wheelchair? Police spokeswoman Jody Silva said the man cornered the officer in his wheelchair and was making threats while trying to stab the officer with a pen. At the time, the officer did not know what the metal object was that the man was waving. Really? He must not have been very cornered then, must he? I mean, cornered generally means you're having some up-close and personal contact when you're cornered in your wheelchair. He couldn't tell what the silver object was. Maybe it was one of those Hungarian things that you use to deliver a tiny pellet of deadly radioactive material. Or maybe it was a ballpoint pen. But the policeman couldn't tell. He wasn't sure. He'd been cornered by this one-armed, one-legged man. And the man came within inches to a foot of the officer. And the officer told him to calm down and be still.
But he didn't. And at a distance of inches to 1 foot, the officer still could not tell what the silver object was in the man's hand, so he drew out his service weapon and blew him away. A caretaker had called the police to report that the man in the wheelchair was causing a disturbance. The owner of the group home, and group home is just a brutal phrase, meaning a place that, well, you know, probably. The owner of the group home said the man had a history of mental illness and had been living at the house for about 18 months. He said the man had told him that he lost a leg above the knee and all of one arm when he was hit by a train. He sometimes would go off a bit, but you just ignore it. The officer did the shooting was Matthew Jacob Marin, don't know. Has a history of blowing people away. He shot a suspect in 2009, too. He came upon a man stabbing his neighbor to death at an apartment complex and opened fire when the suspect refused to drop the knife. He could tell that was a knife. He wasn't sure if the one-armed, one-legged man in the wheelchair had a knife, too. The caretaker who called police waited on the porch out front while the officers went inside. It was close quarters in the area of the house, the police spokesman said. The officer was forced into an area where he had no way to get out. Jesus. Dr. John says, you're right. Journalism fail. Reminds me of that Groucho Marx joke. Last night I shot an elephant in my pajamas. What he was doing in my pajamas, I'll never know. The officer was cornered in his wheelchair. Kate, backing up to the food stamp story, says, starving us one person at a time. Note to Jim, maybe it's a regional thing, but Thunderbird is up there with Mad Dog Plum Purple, and it's cheaper. At least it was 33 years ago when I drained my last bottle. On another note, Bob, you mentioned peanut butter. This week, our local food share came by with a flyer telling us that peanut butter with a yellow lid needs to be tossed out because of salmonella or something. And the commodities program has slipped over the years. What used to be wonderful cheese is now some knockoff low-fat Velveeta crap. Kate says $29 a week is doable if one knows how to buy seconds, day-old stuff, and survive on starch. 5 pounds of potatoes and a case of Top Ramen lasts at least a week. It was easier out there on the streets, dumpster diving, until KFC started pouring bleach in the dumpsters. I was told that was to keep the rats away, but all it did was make the rats taste bad. Note to the audience, come on, folks, someone matched Betsy's contribution. We're honored that she's offering up out of her first paycheck. Thank you, Kate. Ray writing in, he says, I used to have a weekend gig washing dishes at an Air Force base for $20 an hour. Now that's a handout. Ron in Raleigh. According to the right wing, but Bob, according to the right wing, we're number one, the best country in the whole wide world. No one's better than us. Jeeves, it just makes me, Ron says, so sad. Like I said, I've got some stuff in the stack left over from the... This isn't leftover Fridays or anything, but... These things have to be gotten to. Because they are immensely disturbing. We talked, oh dear me, I guess this was the wrap-up week for the Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child. Dear God. We talked about Texas and beating children a couple of times this past week. Well, here's an interesting bit of follow-up. The Attorney General of Texas, who is the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of Texas STAN, and charged with interpreting the law for law enforcement agencies and prosecutors' offices and the like, well, the Texas AG has decided to chime in on a matter of Bible verses on banners at football games. Because I guess all the other pressing legal issues in Texas have been solved now that they've decided that it's okay for full-grown men to beat little 95-pound girls in high schools. What's left? He's offered to help the district and the cheerleaders if they get sued, because what they like to... Yeah, well, you've been to a high school football game somewhere along the way, surely. Yes, you have, and don't call you Shirley. I know. And football players run through these banners that the cheerleaders make at the beginning of the game. You know, with their uniforms on. The fight song being played, usually rather off-key, by a marching band. It's the Kuntz Independent School District in southeast Texas, where the cheerleaders have taken to writing Bible verses on the banners instead of "Go Bobcats, beat the Lumberjacks," or whatever. You get a Bible verse. Like John 8:12, just like on the scopes of our rifles that we're sending to Afghanistan to kill the infidels. The Attorney General charges that the Kuntz Independent School District has been misled and menaced by some atheists who won't stop their expression of their love for their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ at the beginning of a football game, in which the young men playing the game will risk head injuries, life-altering head injuries, in the name of our Lord. The Texas Association of School Boards has recommended that the district enforce the ban based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision that determined a student was engaging in school-sponsored speech when delivering an invocation over the loudspeaker at a football game. But the Texas AG says, you go on making them banners for Jesus, sweet things, and I help you out if them atheists decide to sue you. Or what? Or Matthew 6, 5, and 6? I don't have time to look that up. You got to help me out here, Marty. If you're going to send me Matthew 6, 5, and 6, oh, I guess they're not using Matthew 7, 15, and 16, eh? How about Jesus wept? Really, we can't play a football game without some Bible verses? The parents of the cheerleaders sued for the temporary injunction that allowed them to keep putting the verses of our Lord on our banners before our football games. I mean, I remember when the banners in front of one of the football games when I was in school, when we were playing in high school, whose nickname was the Trojans, and the
sign along the fence said, "Bust them Trojans." Oh, okay, I understand now, Marty. Matthew 7:15-16. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Yeah, probably not. No. Not using that verse. Nor the ye generation vipers one either. Or the go into your closet to pray for the hypocrites have their reward who pray loudly in the streets. Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the Matthew 6:5-6 one. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who's unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. No, no. Wait, I got the pronunciation of that county independent school. Hey, thank you, Dr. John. Full props on your pronunciation. That's a tough one. Yeah, that's my home region, a hellacious place. The whole region stinks of paper mills and fundamentalism. A short hour from Jasper, Texas, where James Byrd Jr. was murdered by being dragged behind a pickup truck by a Klansman in 1998. But they're a pious bunch. Because they got Bible verses on their football playing. Football field entering banners there, and that's what's important. Rah, 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 you know, rah. No, not the Egyptian sun god. Rah, rah, bula, bula, onward to victory, that sort of thing. So we do have plenty to talk about tonight. I got a story here out of Poland. We'll get to it somewhere along the way. But I suggest you have your dinner first and maybe a glass of wine or six and possibly snort a Xanax or two or something. Especially those of you raised in the tender mercies of Mother Church. Now, wait a minute, says Ron and Raleigh. Isn't there something in the Constitution about the separation of church and football? If there ain't, there ought to be. Oh, no. Oh, no, we need to conjoin church and football. After all, no, I'm not going to go there. I'll try not to do any Jesus jokes tonight. Ray asking, so, the faithful are insincere. Did anyone really think they were sincere? No, do not be as the hypocrites. But that's where we stand with Friday on the Front Porch. You are, of course, welcome to chime in. You know the number. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. If you want to save us the toll-free freight, you are welcome so to do. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com. And we'll be back after this little break. And we'll do some conversation radio. This is The Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, we are right at the top of the hour. Hour number two of tonight's Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn begins. I'm Bob Kincaid. You know, of course, you can listen to the Horn in a wide variety of formats and fashions. We're available at places like TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, Streama, Tuner Internet Radio app for your smartphone. You can take the Horn with you wherever you may wish to go. And we will go immediately to the phones so as to maximize the conversation potential of the evening. Hey, welcome to the program.
I have to say I'm very happy with my honorary VIP gold-gilded Stargate. I just went to Planet Colab last night. It's awesome.
Is it just too cool for...
It's amazing. I see what you need to do, for all the veterans, you get the VIP treatment, and this month's special treatment is Stargate. And I know some people say they don't exist, but you can visit the galaxy of your choice. It's awesome.
Wow.
I know.
And you got back in time for supper, right?
Yes, I did. I got back in time for supper. I wanted to visit some of the intergalactic Mormons and see how they were doing on Colab. And, I actually looked out for the Battlestar Galactica colony, too. Because actually I just learned that Glenn Larson, I don't know if anyone else knows this, but it's news to me, Glenn Larson was a devout Mormon.
You know, it's interesting you would bring that up because, lo and behold, Dr. John and I were having exactly that conversation by email last night and today.
Yeah, I noticed that a few weeks ago, so it's amazing that I actually brought this up in sync. But maybe I'm with the NSA and I read your emails.
Or maybe you're just with the Google marketing department.
That could be, or maybe I am with the Illuminati and we see everything.
Trilateral Commission, Bilderberger, you're probably part of all of it.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that he was so afraid to say Colab. He spelled it different. Cabal.
Yeah, Cobol, yeah.
Yeah, Cobol. And then the fact that he was so afraid to say anything that he actually just flipped the script, basically what the what the Scientologists did with,
Battlefield Earth.
Battlefield Earth, right. And...
What a terrible movie that was.
I never saw it. I'm going to have to hold your word to it on that one.
No. No, so at some point in time, you will see it.
I will see it. You know, I was actually...
It is unavoidable.
I was actually... Is Atlas Shrugged Part 2 out yet? I think it's almost time.
It is almost time. Totally different cast. It's kind of like when... Kind of like when one of the boys on My Three Sons got replaced by a different kid or something. But, yeah, totally different Dagny Taggart, totally different John Galt, totally different everything.
That is...
Because the first one was so good that they just couldn't bear to try to repeat their brilliant performances.
I have to say that I would rather watch the Innocence of Muhammad rather than that. I don't know if you actually sat through that film, but wow, how embarrassing. to put that together completely on the level of Wag the Dog times 10. I'd like to know more about who funded this other than the Sam Basile pseudonym, the man from Egypt, and I'd just like to know more about the story because I don't buy the fact that the actors had no idea what they were saying.
No, they're just trying to hide from the crazy people.
Yeah,
I've got a little giggle for you though here. You were mentioning the Mormon tie into Battlestar Galactica and everything.
Right.
Isaac sent this along earlier today, and this is an appropriate time to. It's Friday. We need a laugh, right?
Right. We do.
I'm not sure who did this. I want to give credit. Eddie Current, I think, did this, and it's brilliant. You don't even need the video. The audio alone will suffice, so here we go.
From the makers of Rice Maroney, the Salt Lake City treat. Are you a Mormon? If so, you know that your underwear is sacred. With ancient Masonic symbols that protect your body from harm, Mormon temple garments must be worn day and night by religious decree. But how can you keep your magic underwear clean without risking being seen naked by your wife or wives? Introducing Tide for Mormons. The only detergent that cleans your underwear while it's still on your body. Just pick up a handful and rub in the special purity crystals. In minutes, your holy unmentionables will be whiter than your creepy sons. Tide for Mormons removes grass stains, blood stains, nocturnal emissions, memories of a disastrous presidential campaign, the shame of not allowing black people into your church until 1978, the embarrassment that the celestial home of your religion is a made-up planet called Kolob, and skid marks, because your job is not to worry about those stains. Being totally out of touch with reality has never been easier. Tide for Mormons, now with a fresh Latter-day scent.
That is good.
My favorite part is from the same people who brought you Rice Maroney, the Salt Lake City treat.
that is clever. Yeah, the whole thing with the not talking about the Mormons, we can talk about the Muslims to no end. We can talk about the whatever religion, diabolical religion that's next.
Well,
on the menu,
the thing. It's all religions, though, David. There's not a good one. There aren't any good ones. As I think that post by Juan Cole that I shared from last night points out. You've got Buddhists killing Muslims, Buddhists killing, and you've got Hindus, and you've got Jains burning down buildings, and you've got Muslims chopping off heads, and you've got Christians murdering, and you've got Mahmoud Ahmadinejad gets up there and starts talking about the return of the 12th Mahdi who lives down a well somewhere. And he is immediately mocked by Bibi Netanyahu, who criticized apocalyptic visions. And yet the very concept of a Messiah was sort of invented, as far as we can tell. But, yeah.
I was expecting Bibi to have a spy versus spy hat on when he's had that bomb out.
Right. I'm still trying to find somebody, and I'm willing, I'll capture the audio from that 1952 cartoon Operation Rabbit. I'll capture the audio if somebody will just sync it to Bibi standing there talking with his bomb picture in his hand. Permit me to introduce myself. My name is Wile E. Coyote. Genius. I am not selling anything, nor am I working my way through college. It would be beautiful. It would be perfect.
Liberal talk show host makes Bibi into... makes a Jewish leader into Coyote.
Oh, no.
You would see it on the Daily Caller.
They would
go out to West Virginia and try to track you down like one of their guerrilla-style videos.
Oh, God.
And ask you stupid questions.
Yeah, jeez. Maybe not. maybe we ought not.
No, but I don't think you're on the radar like that. But I do have to say... There is a little bit of celebration in right-wing radio land, just a little bit. Michael Weiner has left the building.
What?
Apparently he was unhappy with his talk radio network contract and said, I don't want to
I'm out of here.
Yeah. I don't want to be a part of this anymore. And he got into a 2-year dispute, I guess. And they finally ended it, so he's probably going to go to satellite radio or something. But he's off the air now.
Well, that's lovely.
I know, that's like a little bit of a...
Neil Bortz going away?
Is he?
Oh, yeah, Neil Bortz is retiring.
Good. Oh, that's good to hear. I dread to see who his replacement is.
Oh, they'll find some young lunatic.
But the other thing I wanted to do is I wanted to report on the... I told you about the... I just watched all 7 parts this weekend of the Mormon drug war, and I don't know if you got a chance to see any of it, Bob, but it's...
No.
Just such a surreal documentary. I guess I can mention a few parts on it. When Shane Smith, the documentarian, visits the... It's funny as hell. When he visits the confiscation room for Mexican police, there's a .50 caliber laid out, and he picks it up and they say we have adjusted that for prints. And then he has to set it down, and then he says, so now my prints are on a .50 caliber gun. Not the smartest thing I've done, but the hilarious thing is just like the little anecdotes, and it's so maddening. One of the things they talk about is how nobody in the United States is talking about this drug war in detail, especially where it involves the Mormons. So when you enter, the whole documentary takes place where it goes right from the border to the place where they're going. So it's like 35 minutes of their travels through different areas and, you know, different segments of the population and cultures. So they go and they go into Juarez, Mexico, and their whole idea is just to visit the Mormons and to see how they're living out there. So you keep driving for a long, long time, and then when you see the Mormon colony, it's like a movie set, Bob. I swear to God, because it looks just like an oasis. So everything is desolate, Mad Max world. Just desert, 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 and all of a sudden you see the golf club area, the houses, the church. And it must be nice to. I imagine that the Mormons get some good subsidies living out there. That's how they're able to do it.
Nice racket.
Yeah. Not in the
oh, by the way, you got a note in from Dr. Johnny. Says, "Damn it, the new Battlestar Galactica is a good show." David, back me up here. Said with love, of course.
Oh my God! I don't want to get into that. I mentioned that before. What I thought about John. I hate to break it to you, but I'm not going to talk about Battlestar Galactica. But very briefly.
No, John did point out to me that there's a, you know, I'm only familiar with the Lauren Green version.
Right. Well, very, very, very briefly.
But the new version apparently has some other cultural elements worked into it, so it is considerably different. But I just haven't seen it.
Well, to me, the problem with that is everyone was basically an asshole in the cast. And I was like, I don't care if y'all die. I mean, basically, when I was watching it, I was like, you're an asshole? You act like an asshole? This is Asshole Galactica. So, I mean... But I do have to admit, Edward James Olmos, he's always good. Always, always great in his depth and character.
Oh, yeah.
That tone he takes, you know? And so it's good to see. But I do have to mention that getting back to the documentary, one of the highlights, Bob, that you'll find very hysterical is there's a patron, there's a patron saint that people pray to, the drug dealers pray to, so their drug deals go okay. And they have this like little booth that they go in the middle of goddamn nowhere. And you can see all the evangelical graffiti. I pray my drug mule makes it or whatever.
Oh, dear.
Or whatever they're writing. And it's amazing. I mean, and they literally, I mean, they just stop there and they go right in there and it's just scrawled wall to wall of all the drug deals. It's amazing. And you're thinking, wow, they actually got a saint for a drug dealer. I had no idea.
I was reading some story not too long back about I guess these cartels even have their own pop stars, musicians who like sing songs about the hard, fast, glamorous life of the drug wars in Mexico. I had no idea.
It's got to be better than that "Call Me Baby Girl."
Okay, I'm blissfully ignorant.
That's good that you don't know that. Or better than that Friday chick. I'm sure you heard that Friday song, Rebecca Black with the.
Oh yeah.
With the autotune. It's got to be better than that. I mean, I'm not endorsing cartel pop, but it has to be.
But there's
better.
A scale. There's a scale.
Yeah, there's definitely a scale. I mean, and the other thing is, I'm sure they have one hell of a stage show too.
Where did I read this story? I can't remember now. But
in Mexican cartel pop, something will come up.
Yeah, I mean, the guy got done with the show and he mopped his brow and got in a tricked out pickup truck with bulletproof glass and roared away into the Mexican night. So
what was your reaction to how badly Fox News goofed on the car chase / suicide?
I don't think that's a mistake. Shepard Smith later apologized. What happened is today, Fox actually screwed up, they said, and showed a guy blowing his brains out live after a car chase, because Fox loves them some car chases, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a mistake, because I think the average Fox viewer gets off on that stuff. Hey, Marvelaine, we got another car chase here. Oh,
yeah,
look, I think he's going to blow his brains out on live TV, Marvelline. Get the peanut butter and crackers out.
And you don't have to show any news developments with what's happening in our country regarding Obama, the election, whether truths are uttered on the political stage. You don't have to show that. You can just cut to a car chase or talking to some model about environmental problems that we can fix with recycling.
Or abiotic oil.
Yeah, or abiotic, right.
I got a pitch for a book about it. No kidding. I got a pitch today from the clowns over at Newsmuck, of course. I got a pitch today for another Jerome Corsi book.
he's making another one?
Yeah. That's yeah. And this is about how the American government hid the Nazi discovery of abiotic oil from the American people.
I wonder what kind of subsidies, since you know right-wingers like to complain so much, I wonder what kind of subsidies they get for these failed books that never hit the New York Times bestseller.
They're all subsidized. Those are welfare books. Anytime you see, does the New York Times Review of Books still do it, where on the list it'll have that little dagger next to it, and that means that there have been vast numbers of the book purchased in bulk? I mean, that's how you find all these right-wing screeds 6 months later in the dollar bin at Dollar Tree or Dollar General or Family Dollar or whatever, is they are bought by foundations by the gross.
Right.
And then they're given out as a premium to you if you donate now. And nobody ever, they've always got, they are, it's a fraud. It's a carnival dodge. It's a con. But yeah, they are all subsidized. Nobody's out there itching to buy the next Ann Coulter book, or God knows, the Jerome Corsi abiotic oil book. By the way, another note coming in from Dr. John with an inquiry for you from your, you got to put on your pop culture correspondent hat.
Okay.
Ask David if he knows anything about Keisha's new song about having sex with a ghost.
I don't really follow Keisha too much. I try to stay away from a lot of the pop radio. I just see like glancing things. Like today I just saw Tony Bennett has agreed to do a jazz album with Lady Gaga. More proof that the apocalypse is coming. I mean, I understand.
And I thought that was Honey Boo Boo Child.
I understand why artists do that, but imagine how many people are contacting Tony Bennett to work with him. And he looks at the list and he's like, okay,
You, not you, not you, not you, not you.
Mitchell, no. Lady Gaga, I'm 86 years old. Well, come on down. I don't know. To me, I always look at something like that and I say, are you just doing it to have a Grammy hit album? Or do you really think that this person is out of sight, the greatest talent?
Do you remember the parody that Saturday Night Live did many years ago back when Joe Piscopo was on the show? It was brilliant. It was a parody in which Joe Piscopo played Frank Sinatra and Eddie Murphy played Stevie Wonder.
Oh, you can click that up on YouTube.
It was brilliant. But that got all of that started. I mean, I remember Ebony and Ivory, because that was the whole thing, is that Frank wanted to do a duet with Stevie Wonder because Paul McCartney had such a hit with that Ebony and Ivory thing with that Michael Jackson.
Right. Well, speaking of sketch comedy, I wanted to mention this, that if you could play that, you played the Dave Chappelle Black President, but the other one that is almost not forgotten, but close to being forgotten for a lot of people, is the Richard Pryor as president.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
Let's try this again. I don't know why that happened, but I was just cruising along, having a conversation with David from Maine, and gone. Audio vanished. David vanished. Every phone call vanished. The interweb tubes vanished. I just now got back into the chat room. Richard says, yeah, I was on hold. My audio vanished. Then call got dumped, redialed, and getting endless ringing right now. So maybe we're back, and hopefully it stays. That's a real buzzkill. That sucketh. We weren't even to the halfway point of the program. There you go. All right, listen, if you are on hold, please jump back into the fray. We will continue conversation for this Friday on the front porch. Yeah, Isaac tweeting. What happened to the show? So there we go. Okay, we're back.
Hello, hey. Bob, it's Richard.
Well, hey, Richard, what's up?
Well, I thought I'd give you a call. We haven't talked in a long time.
It has been a while.
Yeah, and I'm glad that, you know, it sounded like you lost power there.
No, we didn't. Power didn't even blink.
And everything went down. Amazing. Well, good to have you back.
Thank you.
You mentioned Battlefield Earth, which was really something. My county library system has quite a nice collection of films and, TV shows, TV series and stuff. That's the only way I consume video, by the way, is out of my county library. And, I was in there late one day in the library, and I grabbed this movie. I didn't even look at it. It was Battlefield Earth.
I mean, it looks like, yeah, science fiction. Sounds like an entertaining evening's diversion, right?
Yes, exactly. And I put it into the machine.
And everything goes to hell.
Well, it's like, you know, I started watching it. Looks like might be good, right?
That sensation didn't last long either, did it?
Well, yeah. I had no idea I was watching L. Ron Hubbard, you know? It's like, this thing starts deteriorating, getting more and more and more bizarre. And then finally, you know, I couldn't let it go because I had to see how the hell the damn thing ended. You know, and it's like, I didn't believe what I saw. It was just so, you know, blatantly stupid.
That's about the best description. You can't even describe that film in film terms. Well, you know, the plot's a little bit underdeveloped, and the cinematography leaves a little... No, it's just unbearably stupid.
Exactly. The acting is... I don't know what to say. It's American film acting. For better or worse, what's his name is in it, so what?
John Travolta.
Yeah,
isn't he in the suit that makes him kind of look like a human catfish?
I don't remember. I don't remember, but you know, I'm.
I understand, Richard. You're trying to erase it from your memory.
Well, I think I've been fairly successful at it. Erasing it because there's not all that much to erase. It's just incredible because obviously, you know, there's professional cinematic work in that film. You know, the technical work was all quite decent. And, you know, the technical work was professional.
Well, I'm sure that the key grips did a fine job too.
Exactly.
And the best boys.
And my favorite.
And the first electric.
Puller. The focus puller.
It, right.
Nobody can live without... You know who the focus puller is, by the way?
No.
Okay, you ever see those pictures that show the camera on the crane? You know, the crane is going up in the air, and
yeah.
The cameraman's behind it. You notice the guy who's half falling off the crane?
Yeah.
He's the focus puller.
I don't want that job.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
See, he's the guy who focuses the lens as the camera moves and the subjects move. And he's the guy who's like half hanging off the little platform.
Yeah, Lottie in the chat room noting, yes, and the caterers were awesome.
Well, Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be a focus puller.
Exactly.
That's... So, you know, I've been thinking about politics, and I decided I'm voting third party this election.
I think you can get away with it. You're in California.
Well, I'm getting old, Bob. You know, when you're 65, you sort of feel like you're still young. And when you turn 70, that's when you realize you're old. And it's not.
And you have done that?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
You don't sound a day over 50, and I'm not kidding.
Well, I don't look my age either, and maybe that's just a testimony to how you feel, where your mental processes are at. You know, I feel like I'm still a kid. I'm somewhere in my 20s, mentally. Though I've got a lot of years under my belt. I mean, you realize that when I was born, Roosevelt was president. That's really sober.
And, yeah.
And every war and invasion that we have been involved with after World War II has been brought to us by our politicians. And that's sobering. So, you know, our elected representatives have made the decisions that have sent their constituents, our American citizens, into battle for no reason whatsoever.
You, Richard, have lived through a period of time that has seen quite possibly the nadir of the American experiment.
I think you're right. And I also saw...
Because you would have been a young man of, what, 20? When we were just getting cranked up in Vietnam, right?
Yep. Yeah, I was 1A in the draft. I was in college, and I got my BA at the age of 25, I think. And the draft board sent me a note that says, "Hey, kid, you're 1A." And I had to fight them off. And the politicians brought me that experience. The politicians brought me the experience of always having the draft held over my head, having Vietnam in my consciousness, a horrible, meaningless, combative bloodbath that was so wrong. Every American male, you know, who didn't have a handicap and who didn't have a deferment like... Five deaf dick, yeah.
Didn't just bug out and leave the country to go and bring Planet Kolob to the French.
You know, whatever. It's just that we had this over our heads and we were brainwashed into, you know, from childhood into thinking that we have to go serve our country with ourselves, you know. And just the mental fuck-up was so severe. I was in the Cub Scouts when I was a child. And then I got old enough and I thought about, well, gee, maybe I'll go see what the Boy Scouts are doing. So I went to a high school, I think, and the Boy Scouts were meeting in the gymnasium. And you know what they were doing was that they were marching around with rifles drilling. And I just said to myself at that young age, I'm not going to do this. This is wrong. And it's, you know, we were psychologically geared up to give our lives for our country. And Vietnam was not giving our, you know, that was not our country. That was not.
No, and there was, of course, I was born in 1963.
Yeah.
So you've got about 20 years on me.
Yes, that's about right.
And so Vietnam was something that I viewed as a child.
Yeah.
But there was a core of people, even from the outset, who said, this is bullshit, right?
Oh, yes.
There was an understanding early on that the whole reason for Vietnam was probably tissue paper thin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't all start in 1967, did it?
Oh, no. No, it started earlier.
I mean the pushback.
Oh, yes, you're correct. That's true. That's true, yes. Because I was working with draft resistance in my own way in 67. And
now, was this out in California or was this elsewhere?
No. It's a long story, but I grew up in New York City, but I went to, my mother got remarried, and so I turned 18 in New Haven, Connecticut. And therefore, my draft board was in New Haven, Connecticut. I also got my degrees from the University of Connecticut. So, you know, a substantial part of my life was spent there. I'm in California now. So, I don't know, what did I leave out here?
Well, we were talking about early resistance and...
Yeah, there was a certain amount of resistance. I was not aware of it too much until, you see, when I got my bachelor's, I went into broadcasting for a while. And I refused to read the beginning of the standard rip and read newscast off the United Press. The every single newscast, I don't know, listeners probably aren't aware of that, but at least at that time, and you know this, Bob, as that canned newscast, packaged newscasts came off the wire.
Right.
5-minute ready-to-go newscasts, which is why you go for radio station 1, 2, and 3, and they're
all reading the same thing.
They're all reading the same thing. Well, every one of those newscasts started off with the ball scores, meaning how many of them did we kill and how many of us did they kill? And that got X'd out of every broadcast I did, every newscast. But here's a cute little story. One day I'm pulling the material out of the teletype machine, and by God, there's a piece about the New Haven Draft Information Center. A nice little piece. I read it every newscast I did for 2 weeks straight.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I was only on weekends, so it wasn't a whole week. I held the station down over the weekends. And so I made it my business to go back to New York. I was actually living in New York and broadcasting out of Springfield, Massachusetts. So, wanted to test my feet. I was on a station with a lot of power. We got 50,000 watts.
That's a blowtorch.
Yeah, well, I guess you call it blowtorch. It was FM. But it's still a lot of power for the East. Around here, we have stations with 100,000 and even more. But back there, I think that was the limit, even on FM. And it was classical music, which I know. And I decided to go back home to New York by way of New Haven, Connecticut. I dropped in on the New Haven Draft Information Center. And I showed them the copy, and I said, I've been reading this piece on every newscast I've been doing. I'm plugging the hell out of you guys. And I said, this came out of our UPI teletype machine. And the guy said to me, you got this out of a UP machine? I said, yes. He said, that's funny. We sent that piece to AP. Now, it turned out that AP and UPI... the regional headquarters was in Boston. And if I got the story right, they were on the same floor of an office building in Boston.
And Macy's did tell Gimbel's.
Yes, Macy's did indeed tell Gimbel's. Somebody got that story, I guess, from a newspaper. I believe that's how... I mean, newspapers had... a newspaper is, in fact... de facto, the news department of a radio station, in many places. It's the local newspaper that's feeding the story onto the wire. So that story came in on an AP, incoming AP wire, and the guy at AP thought, wow, and ran right down the hall to his friend at UPI and said, hey, take this. put this out.
That's neat.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
I remember I was watching something. I went down the YouTube rabbit hole over the weekend and watched a documentary about the day John Lennon died. And that brought back a raft of memories for me because, you know, that's December 1980.
Yeah.
And I was at work. You mentioning the UPI machine.
Yeah.
Is what took me there. A little baby DJ spinning the gospel music. Here's the Happy Goodman family, you know. J.D. Sumner and the Stamps. Jesus, this is Jimmy. And I read those rip and reads on the top of every hour. But they sent something like 7 bells for the assassination of John Lennon.
Hey, that's something. Yeah, let's explain this thing about the bells.
Well, the UPI machine, now later on they would get these little quiet dot matrix printers, but there at the Gospel Voice, we were the boss was cheap. And so we had the UPI. I mean, this thing must have weighed a ton. Literally, its body, the external shell was made of cast iron.
Really?
Or something near it, or it seemed, because it felt like the outside of one of my mom's iron skillets.
Ours was in a closet. And I was just there all day going.
Right. And so when you were DJing, you closed the door.
Yeah.
Bless Jesus, there's the Happy Goodman family. But when you were doing the news, you opened the door so you could hear the chaka 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 ding 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 in the background.
Yeah.
And they sent bells depending on the severity or importance of the story.
The story, yes.
And so it'd be like ding, you know, one ding means here's the Sunday feature on the best way to make hollandaise sauce. And it would go up from there, weather alerts and things like that. I had never heard 7 bells. And they sent 7 bells for the assassination of John Lennon. And I was thinking, because, I mean, I jumped up out of the chair and I ran to the machine. Because when I got to, like, bell number 6, I said, somebody's lit it up. That or there was a tornado bearing down on us in December, which would have been pretty unusual there, too. And no, I saved that copy, Richard, and somewhere around here, if the ink hasn't completely faded off of it and the paper itself simply turned to dust.
Yeah, that's the real meaning of yellow journalism.
That yellow roll paper, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I refuse to read stories. I had to fill the intermission of the Boston Symphony concert. We were one of, I think, maybe 4 radio stations in the country that carried that broadcast live. Everybody else got it on tape. And so I had to fill the intermission with stuff, you know, until they came back on the air. I had a cue sheet, a pre-written cue sheet for what the network announcer would say.
Right, what your out cues were and...
Yeah.
Breaks. And...
Yeah, so the secretary would leave stories on a hook, usually written by some creep named George Martyr. It was real right-wing, I don't know what to call it, it was disgusting.
John Birchie?
Yeah. And we had the United Press Style Guide. It was in one of my boss's file cabinets. I dug it out one day and I was reading through it and I said, gee, this is really cool. You know, and it said, don't use words together that, you know, hype up things that don't exist, such as, and it used these terms, leftist student agitator. It actually said that. It said, don't use this phrase.
I always loved Mark Twain's journalistic advice. He said, everywhere you would like to use the word very, use the word damn. Your editor will strike out the word damn, and then the piece will read very nicely.
I like that.
Or will read nicely.
I like that, because I do that.
There are very few places where the word very has any real meaning.
You're right. It's not warranted, and I do it. And I write well. But I exaggerate. It's a habit. And you're absolutely correct.
That story from earlier in the evening, the journalism fail on the killing of the double amputee in the wheelchair by the Houston cop that said that he cornered the policeman in his wheelchair.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, well.
I came in late.
That got out. I think for all the hell that people like Mark Twain gave editors, they served a valuable function, and I think they're an endangered species.
Editors?
Because every day, on websites that are not just somebody with a blog, but professional websites with people who are paid to write things, I see stuff, and the first thing that comes to mind is this not going through an editor? Are we just relying on grammar check?
I think we are. I think that's where it's at, you know. I really do. And people editing on
screen. I hate the phrase brutal murder.
Yeah.
Or brutal rape.
Yes. Yes. Hype. It's hype.
It's adjective disease. And adverb disease.
Yeah.
Those things must be used, and our buddy Dr. John pointed it out, because he's a professional wordsmith. These things must be used extremely sparingly.
Yes, indeed. I agree. You know, it's like I watched an episode of a show called Deadwood, and I couldn't stand it.
I am so TV illiterate, it is pathetic.
Oh, it's something out of HBO, and it's a Western, and it's like every second word out of everybody's mouth is a four-letter word, and it's like...
And yet it was raved about, Richard.
Well, I understand it, but there's no reason for it. You know, I mean, as a musician, I can say, you know, I've long had the feeling that if you use a device in music, you should have a reason for it. And you don't use it constantly.
You don't just use the accordion because you've got one.
I've heard people play a beautiful accordion, by the way.
Who was it on the show at some point? I can't remember. You probably didn't hear it, but we were talking about the old gag about banjos.
Yeah.
The you know, the difference between an onion and a banjo. Nobody ever cries when you cut up a banjo. And somebody told the story, or maybe it was on the Skype call last week, about a guy parks his car with an accordion in the back seat. And he comes back later and the window's been busted out. And there are two accordions in the back seat.
I like that. That sounds Southern to me, Bob.
It
sounds like a Southern joke. Well, you know, talking about the bells on the teletype machine, when I first got a computer in 1984, I started diving into the technology of it. And one thing I came across was what's called the ASCII character set, ASCII, the American Society of something.
Right.
And I was looking through it. I think it's also called the IBM character set. There may be one or two changes. This was back in DOS, before Windows. And I started looking at some of the characters in that set. One is called ACK, A-C-K. Another one is Bell, B-E-L. And I suddenly realized that what this was teletype code.
Oh.
You see? ACK is acknowledge.
Right.
And it means, in effect, the same thing as buffer overflow. You know, when a computer and a printer talk to each other, they talk to each other. You know, the computer says to the printer, it says, okay, I'm going to send right now. Are you ready? The printer says, yes, I'm ready. The computer then says, sending. The printer says, okay. Back to the computer. So the computer starts dumping characters to the to the printer. At some point, the printer's buffer is getting filled up. The printer says to the computer, stop sending. I'm full.
Enough already.
Yeah, enough already. Hang on. You know, so the computer stops sending, and the printer is going, you know, is printing away, clearing out the buffer, and says, okay, I'm ready for more. And they go through this little conversation again. So this was taking place electromechanically with the teletype machines. The same thing. By the way,
we started something, Richard.
Yeah?
Ron in Raleigh just wrote in. He said, speaking of accordions. I've always said that if they play harps in heaven, they play accordions in hell.
No, listen, seriously, I've heard people play beautiful accordions. I once felt that the accordion was a crappy instrument. But I've been proven wrong. Whenever I, you know, used to make grand pronouncements like that, it turned out that, you know, there was always a...
Yeah, except for banjos.
No, I've heard beautiful banjo. Oh, banjo can be played, bring tears to your eyes. Depends what...
No, I know. People like Bela Fleck. Absolutely. Richard, this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm gonna roll on and try to catch up to some more of the lights here that are flashing while I've still got service, I hope.
Okay.
I'm taking nothing for granted now.
Understood.
The podcast is now officially screwed up because it's in two pieces.
Oh, well, good luck.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Richard. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. We always have a magnificent conversation with Richard. Let's keep rolling. Well, before I go back to the phones, just stand by a second. I got an email in from Jay on the mention that Dr. John had made regarding Jasper, Texas. He said, whenever the subject of Jasper, Texas comes up, I feel obligated to offer a bit of counter-information. Before moving to Arizona for 12 years, I lived in Cleveland, Texas, not far from that infamous East Texas town of Jasper, where in 1998... James Byrd Jr. was dragged to his death. The sheer brutality and utter senselessness which rocketed the little town to the forefront of every media outlet in the country. Jasper County is very rural and has a very small tax base. The capital murder trials of three men could be a very expensive process. In order to relieve Jasper County of this obligation, the U.S. Attorney's Office offered to take over the case. Under the system in Texas, the county judge, and in Jasper there's only one judge, is not only head of the court system, but also the head of the county government. That explains that goober in Lubbock, by the way, the one who says that Obama and his UN forces were going to invade Lubbock. That was my digression, though. Jay continues, he says, in discussing this possibility, there were statements made such as, and I'm paraphrasing, we think we should take care of our own garbage. In the end, the county held a special election which gave the voters the option of doubling their property tax rate for the primary purpose of funding the trials. The measure passed with a large margin, and the Jasper County court system did in fact take care of their garbage. Two of the three defendants are currently on death row, and the third is serving life without the possibility of parole. So maybe, just maybe, with a bit of leadership from a few people, some of these redneck communities might begin to change. We can at least hope. Signed, Jay from Yuma, Redneck Capital of the West. I didn't know that, and I thought it would be good. I thought you would find that interesting to learn as well. So, yeah. Now we go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, isn't it, Jim?
It is very encouraging that they are, in fact, bringing these people to justice.
They taxed themselves in order to make sure they did the case and did it right.
That was a horrible thing. It really was. I don't see how anyone in their right mind or whatever could do that to another human being.
And some of the outflow from it as well, the cultural outflow was disgusting as well, because I've always been fascinated with radio.
I remember.
Was it the Grease Man in DC who, it was after the it was after the Grammy Awards one night, and I think the winner, the album winner, had been The Miseducation of, and I can't remember her name. And this DJ played a clip from the album and then muttered into the microphone the disgusting words, "No wonder they drag them behind trucks." And mercifully became an ex-DJ almost instantaneously. It was the end of the career. And I think maybe it wasn't the Grease Man, but it was somebody notable, Jim. But there's a legacy. There's just, it's like all these nightmares. They all have certain legacies.
Well, yeah, of course. They will live forever, absolutely. And I just thought about the horror of that particular individual being literally eviscerated on the road. And what is equally as horrible to me is the person who was behind the wheel, and probably it was a flatbed truck and there were people in there watching it, getting their jollies off while this guy was being torn to pieces on the...
There was a truckload of folks who came along and got Emmett Till, too.
Yeah. That was a nasty business, wasn't it?
Brutal, sick, sadistic, psychotic. I don't know how many other words but they're all applicable.
Well, we've all gone down that road before, but I sent you an email about Romney's wife.
Yeah, what did you call her?
I think we should call her Galaxina. Remember Galaxina from the early 80s?
No, I don't. You got to help me here.
She sort of like was a flash in the pan. It was some type of, combination of Barbarella and Wonder Woman. And her name was Galaxina.
That's just disturbing.
Well, it was hilarious. I mean, it was one of the funniest things you've ever seen, and some of the poorest acting in the world. And it was some type of maybe one season or half season run on television.
And how did that escape me?
I don't know. I've seen a lot of bad stuff that's, come off many mediums, whether it's digital or analog, and it's kind of wonderful. I mean, I'll reference my old friend John Waters and some of the stuff he did. I mean, you and your friend David were talking about the some of the things that had surfaced recently, and I was just mentally going back to films like Female Trouble, Pink Flamingos.
Oh, yeah.
Polyester. Remember that one?
I never saw that one.
Well, that was an Odorama, Bob. You missed it. That was in 82. I still have my Odorama card.
You know, that might go for something on eBay, Jim.
It could be. You can still scratch and sniff and spell pizza and farts and stuff like that, but I can remember when that movie came out in 82, a whole bunch of us went to this little theater over in, like, West Columbia. And, of course, those were the days of the electric bong and all that, and we were in rare form for it, and it was just, John Waters, in certain ways, was a man ahead of his time, and I don't think anybody could touch some of the early materials that he did. And if you ever have a chance to see Crybaby with Johnny Depp.
Oh, I know. Yeah, Crybaby, yes.
And Tracy Lords, and that man, the pink Cadillac.
Crybaby got a lot of play in this house, as did
and they had
as did Serial Mom.
or keep your big nose out of her business or something like that. Waters was just absolutely a genius in many respects. He really was and is. He's sort of gone mainstream now, and I think he's made enough money to sort of retire, but back in the 70s when he was hungry and stuff like that, and he was doing his films out of a pickup truck and using cables that were 10,000 feet long to get to a trailer in somewhere in Phoenix, Maryland, where they burned the trailer in Pink Flamingos. I mean, of course, you haven't seen this, it doesn't mean anything, but it's kind of like dancing about architecture, as you say, but you need to see the film.
Oh, okay, we're getting some background now on Galaxina, Jim.
Yeah.
Marty says, Galaxina was a rather cheesy movie feature as the title character won Dorothy Stratton. He says, remember the story of the Playboy Playmate of the Year murdered by her husband? Bob Fosse made a stylized movie, Star 80, about it. So, yeah, that was Dorothy Stratton. I'll be damned. I had no idea.
Yeah, that was Galaxina, and everybody was just, you know, it was just it was a movie of the year. It was just absolutely crazy and just so ridiculously stupid. And
Ron and Raleigh just sent me the Galaxina trailer, Jim.
Well, thank you, Ron. You're really giving Bob a great gift for the weekend. You need to see it.
And David from Maine confirmed it was the album was The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And yeah, Ron said it was the Grease Man who made that crack, and his career ended that day, and he's never been able to find another job, and that suits me just fine.
Well, that's good. I'm glad he hasn't been able to. That was indeed a terrible thing. But nonetheless, I was just thinking when you and David were talking about these films that have come out and some of the things that I saw, of course, when I saw some of these films, fortunately, they were of a much lighter genre than some of this other crap that we're seeing and it's being pumped into parts of the world to cause a lot of inflammation and really bad feeling. It's just, we've just gotten so serious and so deadly about a lot of these things.
True.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, you live in Berlin, I live in Vienna, okay? With you, the situation is serious, but I'm hopeless. But with me, it's hopeless and not serious. And that's about the only way I can sustain a lot of this stuff.
That is more than apropos.
Well, it's called Schlamperei. And that's the Viennese term for it, the German term for it. I mean, you see these things, and there's a whole lot you can't do about it, and you just try to accept it with as much equanimity and poise and a click of the dial as you possibly can.
And that, what Hemingway referred to as grace.
I guess so. Yeah, you were talking about football cheers earlier, or what were you talking about?
Oh, the Bible verses on the football banners.
Well, as much as I really don't care much for football, as you well know, for 2 or 3 years when I was in high school, I was the manager for the football team.
Yeah, you said the Camden Bulldogs?
Mm-hmm. And there would always be a crowd of irreverent people who would whip out a big sign on two poles saying, beat the shit out of the Panthers or something like that, and it would cause a tremendous uproar.
Apoplexy, even.
Oh, people would be, you know, coming out of stands and there would be a cheering section can I repeat on the air?
Sure. Rah, rah, ree, kick him in the knee, rah, rah. Yeah.
No, this would be cat shit, bat shit. He smells. We've got a team that fights like hell. And that's the one that really brought the police out on the field.
Police?
Yeah, the police came out. Sure did. You know, not being that much of a devotee of the game, there was always something going on Friday night at Sinton Stadium in Camden, you know, and stuff like that. And, I don't know. it was just bring back memories of, I guess, in which people were irreverent, but yet it was
done in good sport.
Yeah, and not deadly. That's what I'm trying to say. Absolutely. Well, I'm done, and you have a good evening, and I thought I would just bring Galaxina to the forefront.
I'm glad you did. You've got people running to the YouTubes, even as we speak, running off to see the Galaxina trailer.
Oh, that'd be a good name for Mrs. Romney. I think, you know, that's what I'm going to...
I like it. I like it. I think it works.
Well, it does work. I mean, considering all their extraterrestrial adventures and David's comments earlier, so about his, what, did he have a dream about the going to these places or something like that? Or
no, it wasn't. No, I don't think it. No.
Or creative imagination.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen.
He just used his new Stargate. That's all.
Oh, okay. Okay. Like I say, I tuned in late, and then there was an interruption in your broadcast, and I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, sometimes the interweb tubes just do mysterious things.
They're wonders to behold. Good night.
Later, Jim. Bye now. Wouldn't you love to build a time machine and just kind of go back and sit back and watch Jim and some of his antics in his younger days? Cops on the field at the football stadium in Camden, South Carolina. Oh, it's beautiful. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
I thought maybe we could talk some Loudoun Museum.
Oh, let's do, Rochelle. Let's do.
Okay. Well, I'm calling because, you know, I don't know how much I'm going to talk. Because I'm still working through how I felt a lot about a lot of the ways that this turned out. But, you know, I figured that I could probably rely on you and the Horn family to help me, figure out why this is bothering me so much. So here I am.
Well, I think there's plenty to bother. I have read, by the way, the book cover to cover. I was so taken by that. That was such a sweet and kind and, lovely thing. And I love it. I love the inscriptions in books. Like I said, I hope this will sit on the shelf and somebody four or five generations will go, wonder why he got that. And maybe somebody will know the story.
Cool. Yeah. Excellent.
I like that generational stuff. It's a wonderful book and it's beautifully shot and just dense with information. And just to sort of background up a little bit, let's make sure I get this wrong. Or get this right.
Oh, I can help you get it wrong, that's for sure.
I understand. Loudoun County, Virginia is the richest county in the United States. And they were on the verge of closing their county museum and scattering its artifacts to the four winds, for all intents and purposes, for the want of $60,000. So far, so good?
Yep.
And so we went into advocacy mode to try to save the museum, because when we give up on our history, we give up on our future. At least that's the way I look at it. And you and others did tremendous work of advocating with the county board of supervisors or commissioners or whatever it is that the Commonwealth has.
Yeah, that's one thing you could call them.
And I'm sure as the conversation progresses, we'll find other things to call them too, Rochelle.
Suggestions, welcome.
Right. But you, the museum averted disaster, correct? Averted abject disaster.
Yeah.
And in what form did that take?
Well, you know, this. Whenever you read a history book by usually a pretty good historian or a pretty good scholar, they always go, well, where do you begin a history? You could begin a history, you know, you could begin a history of the Revolutionary War back with the Magna Carta or something like that. So where to start with this story? And I guess not to be too long-winded about it, but, you know, this new board came in the last election, which was last year, and they were swept in on this tide of anti-tax.
Teabaggerism.
Whatever. There is a thriving, let's call it a, to politely put it, a conservative faction in Loudoun County. And they immediately, a lot of them were very new to politics, and you know, in addition to having these ideas, their particular opinions about what constituted fiscal discipline, and they started posturing wherever they had any opportunity to do so about anything. And I watched all of this, bemused and increasingly pissed, but hey, I figured, I'll pick my battle. Well, the battle picked me, which was this whole thing about getting rid of the museum. Well, not getting rid of the museum, as they would say. The requirement was, out of the blue, after having supported this museum for 45 years, the board of supervisors said, okay, we want you to be independent now. And this was, again, this was after having the museum's main sources of funding for most of its existence was the county and then the city of Leesburg proper, which eliminated funding for it because of, the recession a couple of years back. And they said, this was back in March. They said, you've got 120 days to show us how you're going to take this museum, which, you know all the stats, 8,000 artifacts, and, each one of them priceless, irreplaceable, irretrievable, inexpressible treasures in their own way, and we want you to present us with a plan that we feel that we approve of, that we think shows that you are making grade A effort toward getting independent. And this is the kicker. This is something that didn't come into our earlier discussions, but which is remained and has continued to be ridiculous. They said, we want you to put 100% of your collection on display.
Huh?
Yeah.
So no rotating displays, no.
Yeah.
I'm a little stymied, but they don't. I'm sure they don't want to build the necessary structures and infrastructure to do that. Now, do they?
Oh hell no! And why? I mean, why should they? It's just a bunch of junk, right?
Museums, flea markets—they're pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Antique shops. As a matter of fact, if we could turn the one into the other, and I think you know which direction I'm talking about, they would probably be quite pleased by it.
Well, absolutely. Some of those Loudoun County conservatives who talk with their teeth clenched would pay a pretty penny for some of them artifacts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well,
they could hang them on the wall next to their fox hunting paintings.
Precisely. And the picture of them doing the grip and grin with George Bush or Karl Rove or what the hell.
Ew.
So this is what they says. When you and I first, that magic moment when you and I, first crossed one another's paths, thanks to the kind, offices of Dr. John, the, museum had scrambled and scraped and come back with this plan, and the, county staff did not like it, and the, smaller committee, which is responsible for passing some sort of judgment on this, passed a judgment of thumbs down. And they basically the finance committee said, we recommend that the board as a whole not renew funding for 2013, the $63,000. But as it so happens, and I still wonder, I don't know if I'll ever find out the answer to this, but I still wonder, because one member of the board of supervisors was absent for the next general business meeting. They could not take that vote, and as it just so happens, it's the supervisor who also happens to be on the Loudoun Museum Board of Trustees.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. What can I say? I'm not in these inner circles. I don't know,
What could we call it? Mew flu?
What now?
Museum flu?
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
Because, when the cops stick out, that's called the blue flu, so maybe this is the Mew flu.
Right. Or the Sioux flu supervisor.
Yeah.
I don't know. So they got a reprieve, and that is when, you kicked into high gear. Dr. John did. I did. Some other wonderful people on, on the tubes did. And it was marvelous. It was wonderful. It was really, honestly, one of the most beautiful things that I've ever seen in my life, because I had, first of all, I had never seen something that I love threatened. I don't know if that's just because I'm lucky in this world or if there's not that many things that I'm that attached to, but it really hurt to hear that, you know, that these people held this institution in such low regard. And to see others who had no direct experience of it, but who, because they either trusted my opinion or because they just think that this is something that people ought to give a crap about, take their time and use their fora and their rostra and whatever else they have to stand up on and speak, it was indescribable. I just don't have the words for it. And it was, again, it was incredible. So we continue, you know, we press on. We're doing blogging. We're doing tweeting. We're doing all sorts of things. And I'm waiting very excitedly for, you know, press reports to come out because there's, you know, there's some journalists in the county who are very, very sympathetic to the museum and to the county's historical heritage. And the first article that came out really kind of bothered me because it was all about arranging partnerships for the museum with other historical and heritage organizations in the area. And that's not so much what bothered me, but what bothered me is the centerpiece of this article was a member of the Board of Supervisors who has distinguished himself for asinine and ignorant comments about...
Well, I know which I know which way he votes.
Well, you know, he was definitely, I think, well, he was known for when he was on the town council trying to get rid of the town's, genealogical and local history library, which, by the way, has been designated a research site for the National Underground Railroad Research Network by the National Park Service, but who cares about that? You know, all of a sudden I see this article in which this fellow, I'm not going to call him a gentleman, is apparently running himself ragged, putting himself out there to organize these, you know, these partnerships for the museum. And that's, you know, that's great, but I'm thinking, well, where's the story of what's been going on with us? You know, with all of these people coming together and these, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of letters and emails and things like that and all of these wonderful people I've been meeting online and just the incredible amount of support. I get this article about some, you know, the same old bureaucratic high-level manipulation and chicanery that I can see every day in the Washington Post. I thought, well, and I emailed the journalist, and she says, well, but, you know, it's a good point. I didn't put in those words, but she says, it's a good point, but I only cover local government, so, you know, one of our other journalists is kind of working on that story. We'll come a week before the vote. This other journalist story comes out, and it's kind of about the same thing, only in this case it's about how some guy who apparently is, you know, worked for one of the big nonprofits, Red Cross or something like that, managed a $500 million a year marketing something or other. It's D.C., what can I say? We, you know.
Yeah.
Billion here, billion there, eventually it adds up to real money. But
nice line.
Yeah, that was from Everett Dirksen, I think. So how he swooped in and how he helped make this business plan that the museum is going to, you know, to present to the Board of Supervisors and whatnot. And, you know, and there's a lot of blustery talk in this article, particularly from the museum's treasurer about how, you know, he really sees the need to, you know, the museum has gotten a wake-up call. We see that we have, you know, we can't keep relying on this. You know, we need to basically said, act without, you know, without all the emotional baggage. You know, he was the one who was.
Oh, that off. You mean that cool clinical detachment that sort of reeks of the banality of evil?
Something like that, or maybe something, you know, more like that. That is more redolent of, you know, taking an institution with its own special values and characteristics and turning it into yet another exercise in managerial science.
The MBA, yes, the MBA people.
You got it. You got it.
Well, Rochelle, can we back up, or not necessarily back up for a minute, but can I just offer a couple of thoughts here based on the way that you've described things?
I want to hear all your thoughts. Well, maybe that's a bit much, but give me the thoughts you want to tell me, please.
What? And now I have the opportunity, and I'm going to struggle. What you have here, I think, is something that we see time and time again in this country of late. And that is to blow past real issues worthy of debate and discussion and just assume certain outcomes and begin trying to craft solutions based upon those assumed outcomes. In other words, there is an assumption in these two articles that you've mentioned that museums should be self-sufficient,
mm-hmm.
that museums should generate, I don't know, profits. Because even a nonprofit status does not mean that you don't make any money.
Oh, absolutely not.
And that thinking lies in the heart of this right-wing economic theory that says everything may be reduced to a dollar figure, that everything may have a dollar value put on it. And I reject that from the outset.
Mm-hmm.
I see a museum, among other facilities, as a repository of the public good, as a function of the public trust that self-govern, that we impose upon ourselves when we agree to self-government.
Hmm.
We want to maintain a history because our history tells us not just where we've been, but where we're going.
Right.
And what kind of arc, you can almost say that it's geometric or trigonometric because it describes an arc that a community or a nation or a state or a county will follow as it moves forward. And I hope I'm not just doing word salad here because there's something at the core.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like you're describing a process in which the notion of the county has an obligation to fund this museum was just blown past.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Now, I will say that at least 3 of the 9 supervisors have made public statements that suggest that they see absolutely no problem with a majority, or at least a significant minority of the funding coming from the county. But that's absolutely right. That's absolutely one of the things that bothered me about this.
There are obligations undertaken collectively by a people. Of course, right wingers can't even stand the word collective.
No, that's communism, or I don't know.
Yeah, it probably has something to do with fluoridation.
Right. Vital natural fluids.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a real thing.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something else, too, actually, about that when you said all of this wonderful things about, you know, about public and things that, you know, that the government undertakes and good reasons to support it, is there's a lot of historical stuff in Loudoun County.
Yeah. How many hundreds of years worth? I mean, even in white folks or European, Afro-European heritage, how many hundreds of years?
Well, sure. But that's the thing. If you said, Rochelle, what are the sites you should see in Loudoun County? And I was to give you the, say, top 5 that most people give. I would say things like, and this, you know, hopefully this means something to you after reading the book. Oatland, Morven Park, Dodona Manor, and stuff like that. But all those things that I have just said are large houses that were the estates of wealthy white people, powerful people, a Carter, a Marshall, and I'm blanking out on the last one. But anyway, powerful people, and you got to pay to get in to see them because they are Well, they're some of them are private, some of them not. Dodona Manor is private. Oatlands is Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority, but they're, you know, it's different. Now, you do have to pay to get into the Loudoun Museum, but you have to pay $3. And there's oodles of exceptions. But not only that, when you do that, you go in there, you see maybe something a little different from what you'll see at Dodona Manor. I can't claim it's perfect. I can't claim that, you know, that the you know, great diversity of viewpoints, of experiences are totally and 100% universally represented in the museum, because museum collections are themselves products of their time. You know, we need the collection definitely needs to grow and improve on in many aspects. But that said, it's still much closer. It gestures at a much broader and richer sense of the community history than any of those other fine institutions do. And that was why I felt like, you know, they were saying, you know, okay, we don't fund nonprofit, or nonprofit agreements that the county has, they need to show that they stand on their own two legs, blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, but this is different. This is the county we're talking about here. We're not talking about George Marshall's house. We're not talking about Middleburg, for God's sake. We're talking about trying to understand, trying to get the most, you know, the richest and deepest possible representation of our history possible. And that was something that really bothered me, too. I felt like that was.
And it's all been blown. They just blew right by it, didn't they?
They blew right by that. They blew right by that as far as I think if I was to speculate, I would say that, you know, history is it's all one miscellaneous expenditure item to them. You know, if they're
right, it's right next to the. It's just another line item next to the phone bill and the light bill.
Right, and it's all the same thing. You know, it's other. You know, other expenses as required by, you know, some ridiculous.
Well, can I ask you an economic question about Loudoun County, Rochelle?
If I can answer it, I will try.
This is the richest county in the entire United States, and there are some awfully damned rich counties in this country.
There are.
But their budget is. Their budget may be as large or larger than the entire state of West Virginia's.
It's entirely possible. I kept meaning to go and look up how many people's, you know, how many countries' GDPs the county of Loudoun's budget was bigger than, but I kept forgetting to do that.
And so what keeps occurring to me is you've got a budget of that size and scope. What kind of services with a budget that big does the county provide? I would think that there would, with the money they've got there, you would think that there would be the self-clearing sidewalks that heat themselves in winter.
Oh, well, you remember winter a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah.
That was not the case. So are you asking me,
with that kind of budget, it should be some sort of a paradise, shouldn't it?
Well, there's a blog that if you're truly interested in the intricacies or some of the intricacies of life in Loudoun, there's a blog called The Real Loudoun that covers a lot of the stuff that, you know, that gets, you know, sort of basically gets blown over, as you would say, in this image of Loudoun County as being conservative, rich, what have you, and you know, whatnot. They actually recently, the Board of Supervisors gave the Redskins, I hate saying that name, by the way. God, I wish they could change that name. Because they have their training camp in Ashburn, Virginia, which is in Loudoun County, gave the Redskins $2 million to consider not moving the training camp out of the county. $2 million to think.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
That's some expensive thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have my.
So that's where the money goes. You would think with a budget like that, there wouldn't be any poor people in Loudoun County.
Yeah. Well, we could have a whole discussion about this pissing contest that broke out some years back about trying to open a homeless shelter there. Gee whiz. you think they were talking about importing people, poor people from Washington, D.C., to put in the homeless shelter there, but they were not. They were talking about people in the community who needed help, but you'd never know that. Loudoun County is a fine place to live. It's you know, it's well policed. I see what you're getting at. I don't see $1.8 billion or what have you of municipal services. I don't see that when I look at what it's like to live in Loudoun County. So,
and I suspected as much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm gonna when I'm not so mad, I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna figure out where all this is going to.
Well, what you know, and that's that will be a heroic undertaking. It would be really nice, Rochelle, if you could find a friendly forensic accountant who could take the county budget and just deconstruct it like, you know, reverse engineering an iPhone or something.
Right.
Because
right.
That, because then you would see, I suspect, that those monies are sort of traveling in little, they're just traveling in little orbits. And all the orbits, I don't know, not, you know, sort of like an atom, I guess, like electrons around around the nucleus of an atom.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't deviate from those orbits.
Yeah.
And they just circulate because, you know, with a $1.8 billion budget, you would. I mean, really, if you were thinking on a classic American model, back when civic virtue was the prime virtue in this country, if ever it was, you would want to have the best fire department in the country. You would want to have the best EMT, emergency ambulance response in the country. You would want to have green spaces that were the envy of the entire nation. And you would want not a blade of grass to grow out of place. You'd want to make it a haven for young people who want to do the arts. You would have a municipal auditorium that would be a magnet for dance and music and theater and speech. And I'm guessing none of that's there. Instead, it's $2 million to the Redskins to, and now that you've mentioned it, that really is an odious kind of, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, I detest it, but you're not, I mean, if I, it's not changing, I sense it's not going to change anytime soon, but oh well. So you're right, I mean, I
would point to something like a museum and say, look at this jewel.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this amazing thing that we have. Look at how responsible and dedicated we have been with the heritage which has been entrusted unto us down these long generations. But I get the sense, Rochelle, that the people there don't have that long lens view of time, that they don't understand that they are the present guardians of things that have been placed in their trust, not merely for the present moment, but for the future, in the name of those who generations previously have engaged in what has surely been, from time to time, a struggle in the past.
Right.
You know, Loudoun County was in the heart of the recent unpleasantness of 1860 to 1865.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not easily preserved, and I read stories in the book about, you know, what it did to families and communities in that county. And yet, coming out of that, there was some determination that there was something worth saving.
Well, here is where I think I am, is where I'm getting down to the real tender spot for me. You know, they don't care about this. They've demonstrated this. But what really is driving me crazy is that they don't care that thousands of people who do care told them that this mattered to them. Ultimately, I mean, I know they're elected representatives, whatever that means. For some reason, we have placed our trust in them to do the best that they think they can with the resources we've given them to govern us in whatever fashion the arrangement requires, and that's a republic for you. But once you get elected, that doesn't mean, or does it, that you can just set off on your own path and not ever consult with your constituency.
What it means is, and this is especially true, I think, in the case of the right wing, what it means is that because the right wing is structured as a sort of the ultimate form of authoritarianism, and I would submit that it rises to the level of fascism, Rochelle. When you're a right winger and you achieve office, what that means is that the people have given you the power to tell them what to do. That's the way they interpret it. And so thus they do go down their own path, and it is an authoritarian path in which they are the determiners of what is right and what is necessary.
Yes.
And if your political philosophy is that everything must be monetized and that there is no such thing as the public good, you know, you used the word republic a minute ago. Yeah, it stems from those Latin words, res publica, which means nothing more than public thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a notion that look at the number of public sector workers in this country that are out of work right now. They're out of work because there is a determination on the part of the right wing that the very idea of government is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that translates, and it's part and parcel of why I make arguments about, you know, if you really want to change things, go run for county commissioner. Go run for mayor. Run for your little tiny town council. Sit on your local Democratic Party executive committee. Do something. Because the change often doesn't come from the very tip top of the iceberg. The change happens below the waterline.
Yeah.
If I'm making any sense at all. So what I'm getting at here is that I think that what you're describing is by design. And I've used that phrase a number of times in the last week or so because these things roll around in my head and eventually they hopefully coalesce into something meaningful. So much of what I see looks like it's by design. If, for instance, you can get a people to forget their history and forget their heritage, you can do just about anything with them that you want to. Or you can rewrite it. History is replete with cultures that have not been satisfied with their origins and have chosen to rewrite their myth. This country has done that.
I also think too that eliminating history it removes any sense of humbleness. If that makes any sense, it makes you special because you live now. And so you have nothing to learn. You have no strings attached to you. You have no ties. You are an individual acting in the universe with absolutely no external influences. You are a creature of pure will.
Exactly. You are in John, to counter John Donne's assertion, you are an island unto yourself. You are not a part of the main.
Absolutely. It atomizes. It atomizes people and it atomizes...
That's exactly it. And people and communities that have been atomized are that much more easily controlled. They are more easily subjected to the fear-mongering that the right is so very good at. You know, we're broke. We're living... this BS that they put forward about how we have to live within our means, and that's a reason for cutting back on food stamps, for God's sakes, but it's not a reason for cutting back on the Pentagon budget.
Right.
These things exist, and I guess what I'm saying is that you're seeing a microcosmic example with the Loudoun County Museum of a macro idea that is plaguing this entire country like some sort of socio-political pandemic.
Right.
And it drives me crazy because we think, you know, when we think of the commons, we tend to think of, you know, the park in the center of town.
Yeah.
But the commons, you know, the commons are our tax base. The commons are the things that are our roads, our highways, our schools, our bridges.
Mm-hmm.
The things that we pay our money to make happen, whether it's the police force or the fire department or and there's this right wing vision that has this country in its grips that says that everything can be privatized, and that if it is privatized, it will therefore be better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a privatized public water supply here. Isn't that ironic?
Mm-hmm.
And every time it rains like it did today, if you get yourself a glass of water out of the faucet, it's like drinking out of somebody's swimming pool. It's so bleachy.
Mm-hmm.
And the monies that we pay outrageous bills to them, and we don't get better service. What they do is service their shareholders.
Yes, absolutely.
And yes. And so it seems that a sort of sickness has taken hold there, insofar as people want to work within the right wing. There is no res publica. Everything must be reduced to its barest financial terms. And no one wants to stand up and say, you've got the entire paradigm wrong. And
right.
Maybe if I would suggest an answer to any of this, Rochelle, it would be for somebody to stand up and say, we're not even having the right discussion right now.
That's exactly what I've been struggling with ever since. You know, it's really funny. I found out, I found out just a couple days even before the vote that the staff had responded favorably or made a favorable recommendation about this. And I was instantly plunged into a depression because I've just been so confused, trying so hard to come to grips with this. And I think rounding out the story and bringing it up to where we are now will actually continue the abstract discussion that we're having here too, which is that, okay, the county or the museum presented this new business plan that was developed by this guy. Bless his heart, he volunteered his time, who has had his fingers on billions of development dollars for some nonprofit organization in the past, presented this business plan. The board said it was great. They said this is the kind of thing we want to see, and they voted unanimously to fund the museum for one half more of a year, $31,500.
Well, gee whiz, don't spend it all in one place.
Well, and there was, it was accompanied with several very, what's the word I'm looking for? I would call them, impudent comments from a number of people, saying, well, they'll be back, you know, they essentially the essence was, you know, we've gotten dependent on government funds, there's no way it's going to change. And they continue to insist on this 100%. Collection display thing, which is ridiculous. I mean, this is a museum. It's not a cabinet of curiosities.
That's so true. But that phrase you use, dependent upon government.
Right.
That makes me want to just run out into the yard tearing at my clothing.
Yeah.
That concept of governmental dependency, Rochelle, is another one of those godforsaken Orwellian pieces of crap that has gotten into our political bloodstream.
Here's the thing. It's starting to emerge, actually, right here in front of my, you know, it's coming into focus, is that I've lived in this area. I've lived in the D.C. area for 22 years, since I was a child. My parents, between them, have 60 years of experience in government, the military, and government contracting. I know this place intimately, and it's only been recently that I have started to question the model of how things operate here. And I realize we're getting close to time, so I'll try.
Oh no, you're fine. You're fine.
Okay. The thing about it is the way that people around here view. I mean, most of the people who are around here are not politicians. They work for the government, or they are contracted to the government or whatnot. But the prevailing view that I see around here is, we know how to do things best. We're going to side for you how we're going to do things. But at the same time going, what the hell is the matter with people? They're so stupid they don't know their own business. We are always having to rush in and to fix other people's messes. At the same time that people around here are claiming that they know exactly what is right for people, for the 300 or so million people who live in this country and the 7 billion people that are actions, every single one of them, affect. At the same time, on the other side of their mouths, they're saying these people are idiots, they're dependent on us, they don't know what is, they don't know their own damn business.
Well, dependency is what happens if it is something that benefits people who don't have a lot of money. Dependency is code, Rochelle.
Yes, of course.
But on the other hand, it's not dependency if it is going to the privileged class.
Mm-hmm.
Then it is the proper role of government.
Yes.
You're the football thingy just screams at me. Because I think in terms of what would those $2 million do to fund an arts program, I get real uppity about the arts, you see.
Uh-huh.
And so when just anytime you hear that dependency word, I think you have to push back. It is that museum, insofar as it is a. It is the property of the people of Loudoun County. The people of Loudoun County have a concomitant obligation to take care of it. And they don't get to say that we want to skip a generation. We won't, but somebody else can later.
Mm-hmm.
It is an obligation imposed upon them by prior generations. And you don't get to walk away from it. You simply cannot.
Here's the thing, though, is that I think that it's getting a little weird here because, you know, it's kind of figuring out what you mean when you say the people of Loudoun. There's a couple different senses in which that could be used.
People of Loudoun, when I'm talking multi-generationally, I'm saying that the people who put the thing together in the first place, going
right.
back the generations, they still have a vote.
They do. And here's the thing, though, is that the people of Loudoun, or quite a few of them, have spoken. They spoke. They said, we want to preserve this thing. And the supervisors did not listen. They did not take that into account. I sat down and I ate a very nice dinner with someone who is internal to all of this, who is intimately involved in the museum's operations, and she says, thank you so much for everything you did. That was absolutely wonderful. I have to say, I don't know that they really cared about it. She was not trying to be discouraging.
She was living in reality world.
She was living in reality world. But this is where we can pick up the discussion and take it in a more positive direction, I think, is, she was very grateful. She didn't say, you wasted your time, forget about it. She and so do I saw that a good thing happened here, even if it was not the good thing that I wanted to have happen, which was these marvelous people came together and found one another and stated unequivocally their commitment to these values that are so important and to something that I love again, and built a new network and a source, I think, of power that I would really like to figure out how to use to make sure that this script is not played again.
I think the two things come to mind, Rochelle.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think politics has to enter into it. Those people who did not listen, there has to be a connection made with the people who said, listen to us, and were ignored. And they have to understand that there is a political response to this,
mm-hmm.
and that's a fine line to walk in from the status of a nonprofit.
Right.
But secondarily, I think you have to find a new way of language.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying? You have to talk about it differently, and I'm hoping maybe that's what this conversation is, at least tangentially touching upon.
This is what this conversation, I think, has totally been about, is me trying to figure out exactly how to talk about this. Because, first of all, I've had trouble explaining it to myself.
Well, I think just based on what we've come up with here, I would find some way of explaining what I said a few minutes ago, the generations past that preserve this history still get a vote. And they vote fund it. Because they never would have created it if they wanted it abandoned. It's sort of like the constitutional originalism that right-wing jurists use. You have to go back to the intent of the founders. What was their intent in saving this heritage? Well, their intent was making sure that it would be there for future generations. Their intent was not one of making something that would be a financial profit generator or that would be self-sustaining. It was understood that this was a function of good government to the extent that, you know, it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got examples to point to. Look at, you know, just a teeny tiny little portion of the Manassas battlefield was saved.
Right.
If you look at the sprawl, where you get off there, what is that, exit 47, A and B?
To 50, to Route 50?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all
where the NRA is.
Yeah, there's all those sprawl. No, that's Fairfax. I'm talking about back toward Manassas.
Oh, you mean like 234 Sudley Road?
Yeah, Sudley Road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's all that sprawl there, and you know our history marched all over what is now covered in asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there because, and all that stuff is there because a value judgment was made that it's more important to have another big box store than it is to preserve our history.
Well, I got to tell you what was preserved was the result of a bloody fight.
Oh, I know it was. Mm-hmm. I know it was. I remember when there was going to be a water slide or something there.
Oh, well, how about Disney World?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Disney Frontierland, yep.
Yeah. This is just kind of an aside, but my lovely wife Agnes is not quite the Civil War nerd that I am, but we were driving through there on our way into D.C. to do some work on the ACAC, and I just happened to, well, we had to go and buy an air mattress for extra sleeping space in a little apartment there on Capitol Hill. And so I went in to, like, Dick's Sporting Goods or whatever. And I came out, and Agnes looked at me and said, "This place feels awful."
Yeah.
Because she's tapped into that kind of stuff. It's stuff that I can't approach. I don't have it. I don't have that gift. And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "I mean, this place is just crawling with awful feelings. I mean," she said, "I could just, they're like rays of the sun hitting me." And it's all, you know, it's all asphalted over. She said, "Let's get out of here. Let's get on down the road. This is terrible."
Mm.
So I began telling her, I said, "Well, you know, this is the Manassas exit. This is where the first Battle of Bull Run took place." And she went, "Oh." And she had, because before that she'd had no idea. And I realized that's kind of touchy-feely. But, you know, I'm one of those who does ascribe to, you know, I don't know. You know, all I can acknowledge is what I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I take her seriously when she tells me things like this.
As would I.
And but you've got the sprawl of Manassas there to look at as a template for how not to do things.
Precisely.
And I can't. And that sprawl is not going to stop. It will march onward, and it's already happening to a certain extent inside Loudoun County because that's how you get to have a $1.8 billion budget.
Right. Well, I mean, it has happened. You remember reading the book about that split in the two halves of the county?
Oh, yeah.
It continues to this day. As a matter of fact, half the county tried to secede in the 1990s to escape it.
Just didn't, right. And
they were going to call it Catoctin County.
Well, you know, maybe all I can suggest is that going forward, obviously, the advocacy can't end. $30,000 is not an answer.
No,
that's just a drip hanging off of an IV stand. There has to be a real world, long term, permanent commitment to keeping this going, and the idea that the richest county in the entire United States can't afford $60,000 a year. Frankly, $60,000 a year is offensive to me, Rochelle. It's reminiscent of the story that Dr. John sent me a couple of months back about, and see, this is proof that the disease spreads. that the entire the entirety of the Canadian National Park Service, for I forget what the real term is, had been cut down to one staff archaeologist for every park in the country. Not one per park, one guy, one person.
With real long arms.
Yeah. But all of these things are manifestations of this current political disease that says that if you... how do we describe this, Rochelle? That if you can't somehow monetize it, it ain't worth having. And you can't monetize the value of someone who looks into a glass case and sees letters from ex-slaves written from Liberia back to Loudoun County. You cannot. The only way you can monetize that is to put it in Sotheby's or eBay. And frankly, I think some of these right-wing horses' rear ends would like to do that.
Of course they would. I mean, they're serving no purpose right now.
And then they could put that in the county budget and use it to pay some sports franchise to think some more.
Right. Right.
And call that fiscal stewardship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I just got my MLS just a couple weeks ago, Master of Library Science.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. You know, if anyone out there has a job knocking around that, you know, that they don't know what to do with.
But remember, libraries are dangerous things, too.
We can have a whole other talk about this sometime. As a matter of fact, I think we ought to. But at my university, which is a fine, fine place, wonderful, wonderful place to get an MLS or any other degree, they talk a lot. I mean, there's a whole, what do you call it, research center devoted to, in part, doing the calculations and crunching the numbers that show that when you invest $1 into a library, you get X dollars of return on it, in order to make the argument to decision makers. And I go, that's great. I'm so glad you're doing that. I'm so glad we have those numbers at hand. But at the same time, I don't, first of all,
at the same time, it rubs you the wrong way, doesn't it?
It rubs me the wrong way. And also, I don't think that any person who uses a library or who uses the museum goes into it and goes, oh, well, this looks like a real great job creator. You know, this is I can almost.
And until we change the national dialogue, Rochelle, that mm-hmm. kind of thinking will continue to persist. I mean, it'll continue to be at the forefront. Well, you know, a library job creates 4,000 to 4 jobs outside the library, and that's the only way we can measure value?
Well, it also makes me. I've never seen anyone say that for every dollar invested in X, you lose Y number of dollars. Seems like everything you ever invest money in makes money. But anyway.
Well, yeah, it's the concept of value added. Well, I wanted to share a note with you that came in from Ron in Raleigh.
Okay.
Under the subject line, preserving history. He says, a slightly different take on preserving history. My background is in architecture, so this affects me in a similar way to your discussion. The house that Frank Lloyd Wright designed for his son is going to be demolished by some Got Rocks developer after he promised to save it. Do you think the McMansions this swine will erect will have the significance of a Wright home, particularly one designed for his son? Nothing is more important than this asshole's profit. And every last bit of our heritage is, and maybe we don't understand it, Rochelle, but every last bit of our heritage is on the market. And that is by design, and it is a deliberate act.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been a wonderful conversation, and I get the sense it's going to have to continue.
I agree.
The story is not over, and it needs further exploration.
I agree.
You and have, again, congratulations on the brand new shiny degree, and have a wonderful weekend, and hopefully we'll get together again soon.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk this out, Bob, and I look forward to continuing it with you.
It's an absolute joy, Rochelle. Take care.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye.
And I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Because we must have conversations about what the commons mean and how to talk about it. Because if we don't, they'll steal it all. Remember, they want it all. And that's all in all caps. It seems unavoidable. But I think we can turn things around. but we've got to learn how to talk about it. Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful week. We'll be back Monday. And there yet remains $20 of Betsy's Hey, I Got a Job challenge on the table. So I hope that will get met before too much longer. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky, our moderators in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Texas Betsy, our blogger. Thanks to John Fox down in Australia, making all the equipment keep working and me working it sanely. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. A little reminder, we've got a PRISM West Virginia American History Chat coming your way tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Horn Stream and on the PRISM Ustream channel. Hope you'll tune in. They're always good. It's that heritage and history thing all over again. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. Go to ACACT and learn how to be a part of the struggle to end Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next. Have a wonderful